This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Vermont's current Lieutenant Governor, Phil Scott, announced his candidacy for governor in early December, he found immediate support from one former Vermont governor.
Phil is one of the most respected people under the Golden Dome. He reaches across the aisle to get good ideas passed and to resist bad ones.
That familiar voice is Republican Jim Douglas, who served four terms as governor in the 2000s. Phil Scott was in the legislature at that time, serving out six terms as a Republican state senator from Washington County. He's been lieutenant governor now since the 2010 election, and this year hopes to assume Vermont's top office. He's running on a platform of fiscal responsibility and has proposed a two-year budget cycle for the state and a change to the legislative session that would shorten it to 90 days a year. This month, VPR is hosting interviews with the Republicans and Democrats running for governor, and today we sit down with Phil Scott. Nice to have you back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jane.
So fiscal responsibility and economic growth really is your top priority, what you've stated as your platform as you run for governor. And that's something that most governors actually state as a top priority is fiscal responsibility and economic growth. You say on your website, a Phil Scott administration will never propose and I will never sign an annual state budget that grows more than the economy or inflation-adjusted wages did in the prior year. What are you prepared to scale back on to make that happen?
Well, I think we do have to prioritize on efficiencies as much as possible. What's happened over the last six years or so has been that we're spending more than we're taking in. We're growing the budget at a rate of about 5%. When the economy has been growing at a rate much lower than that, around 2%. And so it always leaves a gap. Every year there's a deficit. And every year the legislature has to raise taxes and fees in order to satisfy that. And from my standpoint, I've been in business for a long time. I'm frugal by nature. I understand that I can't necessarily just raise my prices in order to satisfy my spending wants. And so I think that we all have to tighten our belts. We're going to have to look for efficiencies. There are some to be made. I think eventually, if we can focus on the economy, though, and grow the revenues rather organically, that we won't have to force the issue by raising taxes and fees. And again, it's this lack of focus over the last number of years for economic development that has me concerned and frustrated because you just look back 2 years ago, there were 1,211 bills that were introduced in the biennium. Out of those 1,211 bills, there were about 30 that would have had a positive effect on the economy. And out of the 30, only about three passed. So it doesn't tell me that we focus at all on economic development. And I think that that should be the focus.
You've been in a unique perspective to watch this process unfolding in the last several years. So you must see things then that you say, if I were governor, that would not happen. We would not be spending state money on that. Can you name a couple of the things that you would say, let's take those out to get that belt tightening?
Well, certainly, I think that we should be setting parameters when you build a budget instead of going through. And I should add, in my personal life and in business, I ask myself a couple of basic questions. And sometimes I don't like the answer, but it's about want and need. I ask myself, do I want it? Or do I need it? And sometimes I don't like the answer when I want that new motorcycle and it's really it's not a need, but just a want.
And, so what's the motorcycle in state government then? What are we spending on that you think is a want?
We have, again, you look at the parameters that I would set. I would set the amount of money that we spend first and then build it from there. And there are a lot of different ideas on what we can do to get there, but we don't go over a certain limit. And I think you set that line in the sand right off the bat. You sit down with legislative leaders and you talk about where you're going to go, where you're not, set the goals of the administration, set the goals of the legislature, and have those honest conversations first rather than after the fact, after all the wants and needs are thrown in there, and then it's difficult to walk back on. But certainly when you see the growth in so many different areas, Medicaid for one, when a third of our population is on some sort of form of Medicaid. And that's not something to be proud of in one respect, because what we should be doing is finding ways to help people prosper. And so they don't have to be involved in those programs. But also when you look at the administration of Medicaid itself. It's grown by about $100 million over the last 6 or 7 years. So again, there's areas of savings right within state government. I think that we have to learn how to react in a 21st century economy and a 21st century government. Like, why is it that when you look at setting up a business, that you have to go through three different departments to set up a business? It should be almost one-stop shopping. Why do you physically have to go into motor vehicle to get your license and sit there and wait and wait and wait and make changes of that nature? I think that there are areas that we can there's duplication. We have too many silos. We need to reconfigure government in a much more 21st century efficient way. And we'll find those savings, because when you look at the $5.5 billion we spend, and I know a lot of that is federal money. I understand that, and leveraged against other dollars, state dollars. But when you really think about it, what we're trying to save is about a penny per dollar, a penny. We think about that in our own lives, and I'm sure we can find a penny for every dollar we spend somewhere. There's efficiencies to be made.
So I'm going to push you on specifics again. And you mentioned Medicaid. One of the factors in Vermont is that we have very generous eligibility guidelines compared to many other states. If you want to save money on Medicaid, is that an area where you see that we should maybe not be quite as generous in our eligibility guidelines in order to save money in that area?
Well, there's two parts to that question as well. I think that we should be going in to make sure that everyone's qualified. And I've said that for quite some time now, and the administration is now reacting and finding, actually, that there are a number of people enrolled in the program that maybe shouldn't be there. So I think that that's the first step, is just making sure that those who are in need get the services they need to survive. And we have to take care of our most vulnerable. That's part of who we are. That's part of our DNA. We need to do that. But we can't, we don't want to take care of those that can take care of themselves. We need to inspire more. We need to have a more prosperous economy so that people can be more responsible for their own lives. And I think that builds self-esteem as well, to inspire those to help themselves. Gives them a different outlook and a different perspective. And I think that we have a role to play in giving a helping hand, not a hand out. So I think that that is an area that we have to look at. But at the same time, if we can grow this economy and rev it up and restore some of the fundamentals and prioritize that, I believe that we'll have more money coming in organically rather than forcing the issue by raising taxes and fees and looking all the time for cuts. Although I think we need to always challenge ourselves in trying to find as many efficiencies as possible. And I've been through the ups and downs again in my own business, personally as well. And when you do that, when you face those challenges, you look yourself in the mirror and you find ways to do better. And that's why I think competition is good, because you can find those areas where you can do better, and it forces you to change the way you do business. You don't get complacent, and I think that we can't get complacent. We have to react to our taxpayers. It's real money to them, and we're facing this crisis of affordability in Vermont that we all have to take a part in to try and work ourselves out of.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, who's hoping to be the next governor of Vermont. And if you have a question for him about fiscal responsibility, about the economy, about his budgeting plan, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Carolyn in Northfield says, Lieutenant Governor Scott has stated that any budget he submits wouldn't grow faster than the state economy. How would he measure economic growth for the purpose of this comparison?
There are a number of different measures you can go back to federally. And what I've said is that I would go back. I know a number of candidates have said that they would limit the growth to, let's say, 2%, an arbitrary 2%. But I'm not sure that that's necessary. I think that what we should be doing is looking back on facts. And if you look back to the previous year, and again, there are a number of standards that are set by federal government requirements to show how the economy has grown. So we utilize that structure, and then we look at how much wages have grown in that previous year as well. And if we come up with if it's 1% growth of wages and the growth of the economy has grown 1%, then that's what we grow the budget at. If it's a half a percent, it's a half a percent. If it's 3%, it's 3%. And it's a known quantity rather than hoping that the economy will grow to 5%, which has been the standard practice over the last 5 or 6 years by the legislature, is growing at a rate far exceeding the natural revenues. And that's something we have to stop. We have to show that we can live within our means as well. We expect our citizens to. We expect those who are on fixed incomes, they're retired and struggling to make ends meet, we expect them to live within their means. Well, I think that they're asking us to do the same thing.
We have some questions that we're asking all of the candidates for governor. One of them is there any tax or fee in place today that you would take the steps to repeal as governor, a specific one that you know of?
Well, there's a number of them that I don't like. But I can think of two off the top of my head that eventually I think that we should be eliminating. I think the tax on Social Security is something that, again, I talked about the folks on fixed incomes. It's like taxing a tax. And I think that's fundamentally wrong for those who are struggling, again, to make ends meet. Also on military benefits, that we tax them and those who, you know, have served our country and protected us. And we need to give back. And I've made it a point to thank a vet every day at some forum, some function, wherever I'm at. I take a moment to thank those who've given so much to us to protect our freedoms. So we can continue to give back in that way. But there are a whole host of other ones that I think should be cleared up because of the subjectivity. You think back on the agricultural machinery tax. That's one that's clearly been subjective and something that needs to be cleaned up. I think that the soda tax is going to be one that has been controversial. It's not as clear as some might think. It's not about the sugar. It's about some ingredient. You have to be a chemist to understand what you need to tax. And I guarantee there's going to be an audit on some convenience store in the future, and they're going to have not taxed a certain product, and it won't be clear. And I can give you examples after examples. I have a friend that had an audit done, a sales tax audit done at his place of business. And they spent 240 hours there auditing him, got him for $17,000. And they found that he hadn't taxed work gloves. And he said, well, it's clothing. We don't tax clothing. And they said, well, no, actually, it's work-related, so it's taxed. So again, subjectivity. And I think that we need to change the culture of government, I think, especially in the tax department, and we need to be more proactive. His point to me was, you know, if they just spent about 40 hours here telling me what I need to tax rather than 240 hours here telling me, playing the I gotcha routine and telling me after the fact where I don't have the money stashed away anywhere, I would have gladly collected the tax. But I didn't know. And I think we have a responsibility to change that culture and to be helpful to our businesses so that it doesn't leave a bad taste in their mouth either, because after that, he had a bad taste in his mouth. And it's something that was so unnecessary.
One other question while we're still talking about this sort of general economy and budgeting and taxes. You'd like to institute a 2-year budgeting cycle instead of every fiscal year a new budget,
right,
that's proposed by the governor and debated by the legislature. Why would that help?
We actually instituted a 2-year budgeting cycle with the capital bill like 3 or 4 years ago, and it's worked very well. And what I have noticed in terms of over my years in the legislature is that sometimes when you're debating the big bill, the budget, you're still debating the bill that the true up of the previous year. So it just seems like it's inefficient in its makeup. So I just think a 2-year cycle. That's why it's a 2-year legislative session. It's a 2-year cycle for candidates. I just think it makes more sense to have a 2-year budget, and then you can make changes mid year, just the same way we do now, but in a different way. And I just think it would take the focus away from so many things going on at the same time and just clearly focus on the budget itself.
Let me ask you two sort of rapid-fire questions here before we go to our break. On marijuana, your position on legalizing marijuana and what your policy would look like.
I've been consistent in my response to that. First of all, I voted in favor when I was in the Senate. I voted in favor of medical marijuana. I was supportive of decriminalization, but I've said not right now. I don't think we have enough information at this point. We have four other states that have legalized right now. And until we have some answers to questions like impairment on our highways and the edibles and the tax structure and so forth and so on, the governor of Colorado even said, he said, if any states, my advice to any states that are looking to legalize is, why don't you wait a couple of years? And they'll work some things out. We'll learn from them. We can't afford to make any mistakes here. So I'm not saying never. I'm saying the timing's not right. It's not now.
On gun control, this is an issue that's already come up in the gubernatorial campaign, and it's certainly something that's being discussed in national circles at the moment. Are there any specific restrictions that you would be pushing for in state law?
I don't believe that we need more gun restrictions in Vermont at this time. I think we should enforce the ones we have. I think we should focus more on safety and gun education, but also addressing the violence problem that is systemic across the country. And I don't have the answers for that, but that's what's driving this frustration, this outrage, and it's alarming. The horrific acts are alarming. But from my standpoint, I don't believe we need to change our gun laws in Vermont.
So whichever Democrat you face, should you be the Republican nominee, all three Democrats that are running have said that they would like to see private sales also have a background check requirement. That's not something that you'd support.
It is not something I would support.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Again, if you have a question for him, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about education and healthcare and other issues important to you. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today on the show, we're talking with Republican gubernatorial candidate Phil Scott. He served as Washington County State Senator for 6 terms and has been Lieutenant Governor for the past 6 years. If you have a question for him about his idea of a 90-day legislative session or about his plan for education reform, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Wayne in Bristol who says, "Do you take renewable energy and climate change, especially as caused by human activities, seriously?" Wayne says, "I question this because these important issues are not addressed on your campaign website, unlike for all the other gubernatorial candidates."
I do believe that the science is in and it's real. We have climate change. We only have to look out the window. We spoke about this earlier, that it seems as though this year it's extreme. So we have to address this issue in many different ways. I'm a proponent of renewables, and I think that we can find areas of agreement, whether you believe in climate change or not, or it's immaterial. I think there are ways, and that's the way I've done business my whole political and personal and professional life, is find areas that you can agree on and then work towards a solution. Because I think there are a number of people out there that may not believe in climate change but want to be self-sufficient. They want to be able to take care of themselves. We want to reduce our reliance on foreign oil and carbon fuels. So to do that, I think the future is, I think it's in solar. I think it's in hydrogen as well, by the way. I think that'll come eventually. But solar is one that I'm really interested in. I think it's the technology's changed so much dramatically in the last 5 or 10 years. And the big breakthrough for us as a society is the storage of electricity. If we can break through and find an efficient way to store large amounts of electricity, game over. That'll solve a lot of our issues. because we'll be able to utilize renewables in a much more efficient way. So I'm not in favor of industrial wind. I've made that pretty clear. I don't think we need to destroy our ridge lines in order to do that. But I am in favor of finding ways to coexist with solar siting and to provide for some screening and setbacks and so forth, and putting them in the areas that they need to be and where we need the power. And but I think that the renewables make a lot of sense.
Let's go to Paula, who's calling in from Enosburg Falls. Hi, Paula. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I feel affordable health care for everyone is the biggest problem we face, especially in controlling our increasing budget. I want to know if Phil Scott will support universal primary care as a start to that goal.
Phil Scott?
I believe that we do need to address health care in many different ways. I think a lot of it is in prevention. Obviously, that's it's like with our energy. Conservation is most important in our energy policy. I think that gives us the biggest bang for the buck. But as well, in terms of health care, prevention is essential in trying to – it's the usage that we complain about. When we talk about the costs, sometimes it's the amount of services that we use. So prevention is important. I look forward to looking at ways that we can have both a more efficient process. I think the Green Mountain Care Board has done a pretty good job in trying to curb the increases in costs, but the challenge is they don't seem to reflect in our insurance bills, and that's the other issue that I think that we need to address. And a lot of it goes back, and I'm going to digress here a little bit. But
well, before you digress, okay. I mean, Paula's question was specifically, do you support universal access to primary care? And you seem like you're on similar pages in the sense that what you're talking about here is, you know, prevention, negating the need for people to go to the emergency room. So to Paula's point on universal primary care.
I think universal primary care is essential. I don't believe that a single-payer proposal is what Vermont needs or can afford. But I am in favor of the usage, universal usage. But digressing a bit, again, we have a population of 620,000 people. Hasn't changed for a couple of decades, but we're losing our youth. We're losing this demographic from 25 to 45, 30,000. We've lost that 30,000 people out of that category alone since the last census. And when you think about healthcare costs and so forth, our youth are what support the rest of us that are using the medical services more. So if we have less of them paying into the system, that's a problem, and that's the area of driving. You know, the proposal of trying to focus on the economy is so important to become a magnet for our youth to come to Vermont, as well to keep some of our youth here. And that's going to be essential in terms of healthcare costs as well.
Sticking with the healthcare question here, we've got a couple of listeners who would like to push you on your position, your longstanding position now, that we should be moving to the federal exchange away from Vermont's state exchange. Bob in Bridport says, if Vermont closes its exchange and moves to the federal exchange, it seems that Vermont families making less than $70,000 a year will lose up to $1,000 in current Vermont subsidies to their health care costs. Are you okay with that, or how do you plan to close this gap for Vermont working families? And we'll piggyback that with Walter in Montpelier, who says, as a constituent of yours, I'm nervous about your wish to move the exchanges from Vermont to the federal exchanges. If you do this, many Vermonters living from paycheck to paycheck would lose the subsidies that make these exchanges, and I'm no fan of them, Walter says, affordable. How does this fit into making Vermont more affordable, and what are your thoughts on universal primary care? So, you know, both questions there about the federal exchange.
I think I want to clear something up. I have advocated that would be one of the options for moving forward, would be the federal exchange. I think, first of all, we have to agree that their one-of-a-kind ID structure that we have in place right now, Vermont Health Connect, is a failure. It isn't working. There's fewer people than ever thought to be a part of it. And to this day, there's still problems with that. We spent over $200 million on this failed experiment. So we need to fix that. And what I've said is that we should be – I first of all, I think that we should be working with other states. I think we should be working with the Northeast states, is what I said to begin with. In fact, again, if you look back to what I've said and what I've done, I was speaking to the Lieutenant Governor of Connecticut, and we were talking about our woes in Vermont with our health care, Vermont Health Connect. And they said, and as well, the Lieutenant Governor of Rhode Island, and they have the same problems. So they said, Connecticut said, well, we can help you with that. We can actually, we have an IT structure that is cloud-based. We can make it autonomous to ours, and it'll look like your system, but you'll use our structure, and it's fully functional. We help Maryland. We can help you. So I took Tim Ash, the senator from Chittenden, chair of the Finance Committee, as well as Jane Kitchell, chair of Appropriations. We jumped in my pickup truck, and we headed off and met the Lieutenant Governor of Connecticut with all of their people, because she's in charge of their exchange. And they came up with a system they said would work. In fact, they came to Vermont. They, right in my office, showed us a model of how that would work. And they, I brought the administration in. I brought legislators in. I brought joint fiscal in. And they showed us a model where they could sign us up within 6 months, working in tandem with them, working with them with a system that does fully function. So I guess the administration didn't think highly of the opportunity, because I think that the maintenance costs are going to be astronomical in the future if we go this alone, and having it coupled with other states would give us that balance, spread out the risk. So I'm saying either and Hawaii actually had a system similar to ours. They decided to go with the federal exchange, but they kept a portion of theirs as well. So there are other opportunities to look at other states working with in tandem with them to get the same thing. And I think that we first have to get the structure working. And if it goes the federal exchange, so be it. And I think that we'll supplement those subsidies. Because
how would you do that? Because so that's the question. I think
there'll be savings in trying to work with others.
And so you would preserve the subsidies that Vermonters currently get under the state exchange?
Yes, because they need help. I mean, obviously the rates in Vermont are much higher than the rest of the nation, probably because of our community rating, probably because of our demographics that I spoke about before. All that enters into having a higher cost in Vermont of doing business for healthcare. But let's just say if we could partner up with another couple of states, spread the risks out a little bit, utilize some of their plans, maybe more competition, I think we could actually have lower costs, lower rates than we've had previously. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, but we have to be cognizant of the fact that we don't have to do this alone. That we can work with other states in order to accomplish the same thing, because we're all facing the same issues. In fact, integrated eligibility, there's a program the governor wanted to spend $100 million to set that up, and he finally pulled the plug on that. But they told me in Connecticut, they texted me when they read that on in Digger, I think. They said, don't forget that we could probably do this in conjunction with the health exchange that we were talking about for about $10 million. 10% of the cost of what was being projected. So those are the areas that we can find significant savings, but we have to be willing to work with others because we're too small a state to do everything on our own.
Act 46 is the school consolidation bill and district consolidation bill that went into effect in this past budgeting cycle. Jackie and Tom in Weathersfield say Act 46 was originally marketed as a solution to saving education costs. Shouldn't we have just passed an education funding law last session, repealed Act 46, and avoided this inefficient game of musical chairs being played out all over the state with no clear solution in sight?
Well, let's go back a little bit. Over the last decade, I think you would agree that Vermonters have been screaming for relief from their property tax bills. And when they'd have each election, they would be screaming for relief, and politicians would say, we get it. We get it. We're going to do something now. We're going to fix this. And they'd come back, and they wouldn't do anything. And finally, the legislature reacted, and they came up with Act 46. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Are there some clarifications that need to be made within Act 46? I believe so. I think that it was sold on the fact that it included long-term cost containment, as well as preservation of school choice. And I don't think that's clear. And I think that we need to tweak Act 46 in order to make sure those two items are addressed. But again, if we don't, we have a situation right now. And again, I'll keep going back to our economy, our demographics, and so forth. We're educating 20,000 less kids than we were 20 years ago. That's part of the problem. 86,000 kids, and it's costing us $1.5 billion, $1.6 billion to do so. It's our spending on those 86,000 that we have to address, and that's not easy. And I feel for the school boards that have had to wrestle with this over the last few months. But some of them are going to have some savings in the future. But it's going to take some consolidation. It's going to take a lot of work. Act 46, if it did nothing else, it started the conversation. And that's the tough conversations we need to have in order to reduce the costs of education and reduce our burden on taxpayers, as well as this crisis of affordability that we're facing.
Is there a magic number of public schools in the state that we should have?
I don't think you can go with a broad brush. I think you have to do it individually as well, because there are some schools. I went to Linden Institute. They do a great job up there, an amazing school when you think about what they do. They live within their means, but they give a great quality education to so many, and that's an independent school. So I think they do a great job. And there's other small schools that do a great – Craftsbury, they do a great job up there. And their costs aren't maybe – I don't know individually, but some of these small schools, their costs aren't that significant. So to use a broad brush and say, you know, these schools have to close, I don't think that's the approach we need to take. I think we have to look at it individually. And we have to work together and develop, you know, an education that delivers a high-quality education in a 21st century way. And that's going to be a lot of these discussions are going to have to take place all over Vermont. But building more families, bringing more kids in is part of the answer, too.
I'm going to give you 30 seconds on this. You also have a proposal to go to a 90-day legislative session that would shorten the session. It would end probably by the end of March if we started at the same time. Why?
Yeah, because as I've seen over the last number of years, I think you need to prioritize. I think that I think as well, if you had a 90-day calendar session where you could tell somebody April 1, you'll be out of here, I think it will bring a different perspective to the legislative arena. I think more people would run from different backgrounds. And I think the Citizens Legislature in Vermont is part of what makes us unique. And I want to preserve that. And to do that, we have to allow people to run and to be able to do that, take time off from work in order to get involved. And so the 90-day session is something that's doable, and I think that we could get our work done, prioritize, and have more people involved in the process.
Phil Scott is the current lieutenant governor, hoping to be governor next year, running for the Republican nomination. Thanks very much for being
with
us.
Thanks very much, Jane.
His opponent in the primary will be our guest on Friday. If you have a question for Bruce Lissman, send it to vermontedition@vpr.net. And in between, we've got Democrat Matt Dunn on the show tomorrow. This is all part of our Meet the Candidate series of interviews. Coming up, as many as 20,000 people are expected to descend on Mount Tabor over the next 2 weeks for an annual celebration known as the Rainbow Gathering. We'll get the details next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Rainbow Family of Living Light is a loose affiliation of people from around the country, even internationally, that gather together every year to celebrate their ideals of nonviolence and love. They have no leadership structure and often call themselves non-members. Their annual gathering this year is in the Green Mountain National Forest, specifically the Mount Tabor area. Officials are estimating that 10,000, maybe even 20,000 people could show up in the forest to set up tents and build temporary shelters. That's a lot of people for a generally pretty quiet and rural part of the state. So here to tell us how they're preparing and what they expect is John Sinclair, Forest Supervisor with the Green Mountain and Finger Lakes Division of the U.S. Forest Service. John, nice to talk with you again.
Great to talk to you. Thank you for having us today.
Do you have a sense of how or why the Rainbow Family picked this particular area to have their gathering this year?
Well, nationally, every year they hold this annual, what they refer to as their annual gathering, and it is on U.S. Forest Service land somewhere in the United States. And they've been interested in coming back to the eastern part of the country. They visited us last year to ask us questions about our forest and areas on the forest that might support or be able to handle this number of people. But primarily they are in the West, but they have a contingent that's spread from coast to coast, and those that Rainbow family members from the East wanted to host a gathering, and the last time they were here on the Green Mountain National Forest was 1991 in Granville. And I've heard from some of them, whether it's the official statement from the family is hard to tell, but it's their 25th anniversary, and they were excited to come back to the Green Mountain National Forest.
And the activities that you expect to see during this time from the gathering?
It's varied. Most of them are just camping and communing out on the landscape. Driving through, you see a few of them sitting around playing music, fiddles, flutes, guitars. But mostly they're camping, like anyone else would do, out on the landscape celebrating the 4th of July holiday time. They're just doing it in a much different manner than what others would use. You know, tents are the atypical. There's a lot of tarps and buses and just sleeping out under the stars.
And I understand building temporary kitchens and other structures that then can be taken down in a couple of weeks. And is that okay in terms of the impact on the landscape and the drain on local resources that it may have?
Having 10,000 people to 20,000 people is definitely going to have a impact on the landscape, without a doubt. We have set up an operational plan. There's no one in the family that will actually sign a permit to utilize the forest because they are that loose affiliation and no one speaks for the family, Rainbow family, in and of itself. So we have established a operation plan, which we are currently enforcing out on the landscape, and it has mitigation measures regarding where they can build their ovens and their kitchens, how close they are to water supplies, where they can put their pit and trench toilets in the landscape. So we do take our resource protection concerns on our behalf, and we enforce them to the greatest extent we can. And so far, they have been amenable to those requests.
Though this isn't without some controversy. As of this morning, the latest update sent out by the Forest Service is that there have been a total of 16 warning notices, 8 violation notices for traffic and drug-related offenses, and 13 other incidents that received law enforcement responses. There's also a somewhat bizarre story about some of the visitors stealing a dog from a local humane society. And I should say that dog, Fred, was recovered and seems to be none the worse for the wear. But are you concerned about that?
Yeah, without a doubt, we have a cross-section of people up there. Some of them will never give us a problem. They just want to be left alone and camp on the landscape. But when you have 10,000 people coming in, there is a cross-section, and there's folks or family members that are looking or are into illegal activities, whether it be drugs, violence, traffic issues. We see it all up in the gathering site itself. So we are concerned. We have a large contingent of law enforcement from the Forest Service itself that has come in from around the country. We've set up a national incident management team structure that allows us to utilize interagency efforts and have a command. We have support from the state police, local sheriffs, local police, fire and rescue, local town officials. State Department of Health have been up to the areas. We've been in communication with hospitals. So we're really reaching out because the safety of the public and employees and those up in the gathering site itself, it is an incredible concern for us.
That's John Sinclair, Forest Supervisor with the Green Mountain and Finger Lakes Division of the U.S. Forest Service. Thanks for telling us a little bit about this rainbow gathering.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, our Meet the Candidates series continues with Matt Dunn. He's one of three people in the Democratic primary for governor, and he'll take your questions and comments live at noon. Send us your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net, and be sure to tune in for that conversation tomorrow. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.